Good morning. This is December 7th, 2015. I'm Mario Gard Ewell with the Gard Foundation, and I'm here in Evergreen, Colorado, interviewing Richard Zellner at his beautiful home. Good morning, Dick.
Good morning.
So we've got some questions. They're kind of similar to the ones that we've used with the other folks, starting with your early childhood and then moving up to focus on your time in music at the University of Wisconsin and all of the extension music people that you knew and what you did and what it all meant. So if you're ready, we can just jump in.
Okay.
So tell me about your very beginnings. In other words, before you were even conceived, your family and your background. Who were your parents and what did they care about?
I was born in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, and I lived there till 1949 when a family moved to Green Bay. And my dad was working in a cheese factory and was in charge of the shipping floor. And he moved to Green Bay, Wisconsin, so that's where I went started. I was in school in third grade there and went through the time I got married. So
were your parents long-term Wisconsin people?
Yes, they were there. We did some chasing of the family roots. The Zellner side came from the Germany, Austria, Czechoslovakia border. In fact, there's a book about them called The Border People, because where they lived, it was either the Habsburgs or the Ottoman, and the country, the borders were changing, so they were called Border People. And my great-great-grandparents came to Wisconsin in the 1860s. Luxembourg, Wisconsin, is where most of them settled in that area. And a lot of them were dairy farmers in Wisconsin and never traveled very much. And like I was probably one of the, probably the number three in our relations. So all our relatives had an opportunity to go to college. But they were all very supportive, and we spent a lot of time between Manitowoc, Two Rivers, Luxembourg, and Green Bay. That's where my early childhood was.
Hmm.
So my music background started like when I was in sixth grade. My dad had an old Sears Silvertone cornet, and I played in the All-City. There was Norbert Ecker had this music program. I started playing the cornet and gravitated to the trumpet. And basically, that was my introduction to music. So my early professional playing, I didn't really start playing professionally in bars and everything until I was about 13.
So what made you pick up that cornet? Did your parents, were they music lovers?
Yes, they were, but it was the Bohemian, Czech, German, and Polish folk music, dancing polkas and waltzes. And so I ended up going places where they would be dancing, and I would sit on the stage, watch the trumpet players, and then eventually I started doing that myself.
So it was just the trumpet you watched? You weren't coveting the saxophone?
No.
Or
no, not at all. And I really enjoyed doing that, and so I ended up, you know, starting to play quite a bit for money, and I went to St. Philip's Grade School in Green Bay, and then a lady of Premontre High School, an all-boys high school, which was a private school, and I used to play. I was making money to help pay for my tuition. When I would come home from my dance job, my mother would be there with her hand out to ask how much money, get the money.
How on earth were you able to get a trumpet then?
Well, they were very supportive. You know, they really enjoyed the fact that I was doing this. And of all the things in my whole career that I'd done in music, the thing that they were most proud of was that I played in trumpet in the Packer band when Lombardi was coach.
Okay.
So from 59 to 63, I was in the Green Bay Packer band, which was big deal in those days.
I got to interrupt and say we interviewed Karen Cowan, who's part of the dance program, and she would have been one of the Packer cheerleaders in those days. Little did you know.
People don't realize that in those days, the Packer band, there were about 26 of us, we played big band jazz. We had like five trumpets, five trombones. And we sat on the 30-yard line right off the Packer bench, and we would go at 9 in the morning, and the Packer players and the visiting teams would come out in their sweats to warm up, and we would play for them before anybody came into the stadium. It was before the big sound systems and stuff.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It was really a thrill.
And of course, a lot of them at the time were band directors in the area, people like that that played instruments, so I was always connected with the music education field through starting with the Packer band.
So were you still in high school then when you were
in college, 59, so I would have been 19.
So where were you going to college, at St. Norbert's?
St. Norbert. Uh-huh. Right. So what happened is... I had got accepted to Notre Dame and signed up and everything and never mentioned much to my parents and didn't have a clue that they could no way afford that. And so Nubby Ecker started me in the grade school program. Then he was the band director at Premontre, so I played for him. Then he started the music department at St. Norbert, and he offered me a full scholarship if I would play trumpet in all the musical organizations. Dudley Birder was there doing musicals, and I would play in the pit, and then I would play in the bands and the jazz band and all the stuff. So I never had any student loans. I actually picked up a grant and aid check when I went to register.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, how wonderful.
I don't even want to tell anybody today about that.
Well, now the truth can be revealed.
So when I graduated, I got married in my senior year, I automatically wanted to go and get a master's degree. So
before you graduated, I assume you were a music major, or did they have music majors?
Yes, I was a music major at St. Norbert. Music education, I became certified. Practice taught. It was really interesting. My senior year, two things that were really interesting that happened. One was I was practice teaching at West DePere High School, and the East DePere High School band director became ill. And so they sent me in, and I substituted and took the band to the contest in Kewaunee, Wisconsin. I mean, that was my first, just inundated, thrown right into the fire. And so that was quite an experience. And then a lot of people were coming to interview us, music majors from the area. And I'll remember a guy from Mishicot High School offered me the band director job in Mishicot. And my dad went to Mishicot High School. He was the first one of Zellners to go to high school. He even had to live with a family. He couldn't stay. Can we stop a minute?
Sure.
Father was, and it's interesting, I didn't accept the job. I wanted to work on my master's degree. And so I turned it down. But a colleague of mine at St. Norbert took the job in Mishicot and stayed there his whole career.
I'll be darned.
And we've been friends. He's directing, he's, even in retirement, I think he still directs the Two Rivers Municipal Band. And it was just fascinating how that turned out. So basically then, we got married in January, and in June I went to Madison to start on my master's degree in music. And then I didn't have a job, and so the thing, Chummy went to University of Wisconsin for 2 years, and there was a doctor's family, Arthur Steenen. And how many kids did they have?
Seven
kids. And she lived with that family by West High School for 2 years while she went to Madison. Now, you didn't live the whole time. You went to Elizabeth Waters for a while.
That probably doesn't. Yeah. Probably doesn't.
Okay, we're restarting. There was just a moment of personal coincidence when Dick mentioned the Steenen family, so I had to stop and exclaim. So now we're back. So Dick is in Madison. Chummy is going is also in Madison.
Well, but we never went to the same school together, because then she went to La Crosse, to St. Francis Hospital of Viterbo. There was a program for medical records, and that she went into her certification program there. So, but in June, I went to Madison, and the Steenens, somebody mentioned to the Steenens that I was coming for summer school. I was just going to do summer school. And they lived right by West High School, right on the corner, about five houses away from this guy named Dick Wolf. And so, Steenen said, you should talk to Dick Wolf. So when I went to Madison, so this was 1960. June. We got married in January. June, I went down and I met Dick Wolf in the Memorial Union, and we connected, and he offered me a job as a counselor at the music clinic. I was the counselor at Elm Drive C dorm for the summer music clinic, and I signed up for a program. I wanted to major in music, so I played, brought my trumpet, and you know, so I remember my audition, and people that you want to talk about music, I go to my audition in this old building off right by Rennebaum's, where the music people were. One of the greatest horn players ever is John Barrows, the principal flute from the Philadelphia Orchestra. We just came on the faculty as a flute player. Bob, I can't remember, I have to come up with his name. But anyhow, I had to audition for these guys. I mean, these were people that were icons in my mind. And they were not impressed that I played in a Packer band. But I'll never forget that. And so I got into the program, now I can't remember his name. The principal trumpet from the Philadelphia Orchestra was there substituting that summer. But anyhow, I got into the dorm, so I'm working in the dorm, and I'm taking my courses there. And so that, even though I didn't get into extension until 66, I was connected with that culture of music and those band directors. So what happened is they introduced me to a guy named Leroy Closey, K-L-O-S-E, who was the supervisor of music for the Madison Public Schools. And he had some job openings, and he brought me in his office and auditioned. He was just an outrageous, irascible, curmudgeon kind of person. And interviewed me, and before the summer was over, I was offered a job as the band director at Madison East High School. Bob Woolen was doing the orchestra and the band, but I was brought in to do the marching band and all the other things. And then we moved that fall to Madison, and 2410 Brentwood Parkway.
Oh, I can't believe
that. And Chummy was pregnant with our first son, and I started my teaching job at Madison East. And I, for some reason, I was committed to getting a master's degree, and so I started going to school. I took some classes in the evening, not many, but more, and then intense in the summer. And I was majoring in music with a minor in administration of higher education. Took administration of higher education courses. And then so for 4 years I had this great experience with this Bob Woolen who mentored me, and but once again I was ensconced in the music educators, professional musician culture, which was, you know, circulating around the campus of University of Wisconsin.
And did you stay in touch with Dick Wolf all of this time?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because what happened then in the summer, I know he mentioned in his interview, Ray Dvorak was the band director, and Ray was my my thesis advisor. So I wrote a band arrangement of the Glazunov Ballet, The Seasons, for my master's degree, and Ray Dvorak. But anyhow, Ray always had me playing in his summer band. We used to do the concerts on the patio in the Memorial Union. And a lot of the music major trumpet players that were there weren't necessarily there in the summer. So there was a place for me, and I got to really know Ray very well. Of course, Dick Wolf was very closely connected with him, and I was going to working on my master's degree. So, in 1965-66, I saw a thing about a brochure on the wall. I finished my master's degree in 65. I got it, you know, part time. And had it, and so I saw an ad for an adult and continuing music education program, which was an extension, University of Extension Music, and there was this guy named Emmett Sering who was heading up this program. So I, and of course Dick Wolf was in the department, so when Dick had me there, and then when I was band director, you know, I was always involved with the stuff at the university as well as Madison East High School. And Sering, who had talked to me in the program, was really very interesting. He had made a relationship with adult education department, Robert Kreitlow and Robert Boyd. Robert Boyd was my major professor, because then I decided that I was going to work on a doctorate, and I got a graduate assistantship an extension that Sering had set up. And at that time, they were in the Towers building, the offices. And so as soon as I took a leave of absence from Madison East for 1 year and started full time with this graduate assistantship that Sering set up for me. And so I was immediately in the offices there. And your dad's office was there. And my first job, my first year, was the Wisconsin State Fair, and Ed Hugdahl was running that program. And Ed, he was so organized. I mean, he basically handed me this three-ring binder, the big three-inch things, and it had all the bands. So I would go in the summer to Milwaukee to the state fair, and they had this big tent stage with all set up with chairs, and all the high school bands in Wisconsin would come, you know, their big field trip to Milwaukee, West Allis, to play a brief hour concert. And so I would meet the bus and get them organized, and then I would set them up, help them set up, and then I would announce who they were. And so I got, you know, Chummy gets mad. We drive from Milwaukee up to Green Bay. Every one of those towns always had a band that came to Madison. And, but, you know, so it was, so what really, then a lot of stuff that started touching me then was that, like Johnny Carson, the Tonight Show band with Doc Severinsen, were at the fair. They were a big headliner. And I remember that I would help with the staging, because I was working with the stages where all the music was at the stage, and I had a doodabug, one of these little things which you couldn't even see under me. I remember driving around with that. But it was a real different kind of sense of show business. Oh, so then I forgot to mention that after Dick Wolf set me up, well, the first thing happens, I run into this guy named Jim Christensen. And Jim Christensen is doing the marching band. And so I became an assistant. So he hired me to be the film guy for the marching band. So
at halftime,
at the university band. So at halftime, I would go up to the press box and do movies of the marching band. And then, Dick Wolf and Jim had me help with like the Allstate band when they have the band day. There'd be 1,000 kids, and Ray Dvorak would yell at them and conduct, you know, and do all the stuff. And so I got into the whole university marching band thing, the traditions that Ray Dvorak established, you know, varsity and all that stuff. Yeah, you rah, Wisconsin. So, it was a real kick to do that, to get into the stadium and be part of that. But in those times were the politically incorrect times. So when I got with Dick Wolf, and the first year I was there, Jim conducted one of the summer bands and heard me play trumpet. He wanted me in the Haresfoot Orchestra. Haresfoot were all male music majors doing musicals. And the first one I did was Destry Rides Again. And this was really serious stuff. These guys were all serious, but they were all men. And we would go on tour. We played the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee. We went to Sheboygan, all over with this group. And the people that I was with, like Phil Ahom, he's a clarinet sax player. I mean, a lot of these real stellar music majors are in that orchestra. So even by 63, I was just ensconced in the whole occult music culture of Madison, the university, the band directors, and all that stuff. I was just part of it.
So can we just pause for a second and backtrack? Because I'd love... Just, I know you're going to talk about Dick later,
yeah,
I'm sure,
yeah.
And Ed Hugdahl and people like that, Ed Abbott. But could you just give a kind of a little character sketch of each of the three of them, especially Emmett and Ed, because they passed away before we could record them.
Right.
So tell me about Emmett first.
Okay, well, Emmett is one of my heroes. And it was interesting. I mean, I don't know for sure if I have all the facts, but it's my understanding that when Ray Dvorak was in a train accident and lost his arm, he was in a period of recuperation. He couldn't do any of his usual job. Emmett was brought in to be the band director at University of Wisconsin. I don't know what year it was, 40s. And... So Emmett came out of the band director thing, and then when Ray came back, Sarah stayed at the university. And I think that's what, you know, Dick Wolf or some of those other people know about how extension music developed, but then Sarah naturally went into that position. So the thing about Emmett was that, I mean, he was, in a sense, a lot of times controversial. I don't know if he did do a good job with the musically, but he had such insight as to how to get things done. So, for example, when we, Mike George and I, well, I started it, Mike came later, but the Youth Music Project, we wrote a grant. And we got $250,000 from the Music Professional to Teacher Professional Development Act or something. A guy named Harold Arberg in Washington was head of that. And Sarig wanted to get this money, and he had this idea that there was so much going on with the rock and roll phenomenon, because the Beatles were going on. This is in the 60s now. And there was somebody who did some research where kids were dropping out of music programs in schools to get more music because the school programs weren't doing it. So Emmett spearheaded us with this idea machine, but Emmett's idea to get, let's get these kids who dropped out of programs to be the teachers of the band directors to help them understand what they needed to know to connect. And, so the thing that me about Emmett, and this is one thing I learned from him, and I practiced this my whole career. Dick, let's get on a plane. Let's go see Harold Arber. And we went to Washington, and we got this grant for $250,000, which was a lot of money. And but the other thing he did was he said the Music Educators National Conference needs to be involved. So what happened is when we talked about this project, everybody said, you guys are nuts. That music is stupid. It's not even good. You know, what are you thinking? So Emmett said, well, we have to have MENC involved. Dick, let's get on a plane and go to MENC. So we went to Washington, and Charles Gary was head of MENC, and this young guy named Charles Fowler was editor of the Music Educators Journal. And so Emmett, we laid out our idea, and they weren't very hot on it. And Emmett said, you have to be involved in this. This is very important. And eventually, Charles Gary committed for Charles Fowler to come to the whole program because it was a summer event. Then, I remember Charles Gary was the manager of MENC, the executive director. Louis Worson, another irascible curmudgeon, was head of the music programs in Philadelphia. And there was a guy named Harold Doolin, who was a music supervisor in Miami. And these guys were like Leroy Closey. They were this old school. They just wouldn't have anything of it. And so the Youth Music Project was, we were going to bring 20 rock bands, kids. But the condition was that they shouldn't be covering other people's music. They should be creating their own music. And Emmett said, you know, God damn it, Louis, you have to recommend these kids. They have to come through you. I want them. And he hated the whole thing, but Emmett made them do it. So Howard Doolin in Miami, and then, so that ties into when I went to Florida State. I already had a relationship with Howard Doolin because, you know, and so Emmett made these guys come in. So I think even today, the Charles Fowler published a special edition of the Music Educators Journal that had this insert to youth music. You can still buy it today. Charles Fowler wrote that. And the MENC basically, and so Mike George, like with the Wisconsin Music Association, like 5 years ago before he retired, or 10 years ago, when he started this garage band thing, it was all the roots were in this youth music project.
That's amazing. So what happened with the youth music project? Did 20 bands?
Oh, yeah, we got them together. We had, in fact, I was negotiating with Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Camp Randall. We were going to do Blood, Sweat, and Tears in Camp Randall Stadium. But we had to take the financial risk, and so we ended up with the New Colony Six, Good Morning Star Shine, da 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 da. That singer, mm-hmm. We had him and another group. So we had three professional rock groups. We had 40 music educators, band directors, and 40 guidance counselors, and 20 rock kids. And we made the kids the teachers. And it was all, I mean, Emma just, but We were endorsed by the Music Educators National Conference. Charles Fowler, the editor of the magazine, was in the room and wrote this beautiful article because it all was working. And Mike George and I worked together, and that's where Mike and I really developed our relationship because we were under the gun because Emmett, you know, didn't do the daily chores. It was Mike and I. And I remember when I went to Florida State and we were still doing a final report, Mike sent me a 8x10 picture, and it was he and I. We did Camp Randall, but we did it only in the bowl. We only had about 3,000 people. But it was a picture of Mike and I pushing an upright piano across the football field, and Mike administrated. But that had such a profound influence. That's why I think, you know, and Dick, you know, Dick was part of it, but he wasn't in it like Mike and I were running it. And of course, it was Sarek's idea, but everybody, I was always inspired by Emmett. Everything I did in fundraising and everything, get on a plane and talk to him face to face. I mean, I just knew that, and get the right people involved, even though they're not supportive initially. So, this is going to go on for a time because Emma was something else. So when I got there to be a graduate, I started my PhD program in 66. I didn't know what was going on, but all of a sudden Emmett said, I hired this guy named Marvin Rabin.
And he's hired him?
No, Emmett did. He told me he was hired, and I want you're going to work with him. And Mike George and I always joke that Marv had not finished his doctorate, but he brought all of his doctorate in a bushel basket, and Mike and I put it all together. He finally got his doctorate finished. But, I just want to digress here a minute. I have three or four heroes in my life, and of course Emmett is one, but one is Marv Rabin, and I started this thing, I never did it. I was going to do kind of a website called What Were You Thinking? And I wanted to go, and I did this with Marv, because I went to Marv, I read him a long email, I said, Marv, in the 50s, middle 50s, you were in Louisville, Kentucky, and there was no such thing as a youth orchestra, and you started a youth orchestra. What were you thinking? Then, a little later, he went to Boston and created the Greater Boston Youth Symphony, you know, and it just was a major program, and he even has a picture of Marv. Jackie Kennedy, they had him to the White House, the Greater Boston Youth Symphony. And he was working with the University of Boston and all these people, and this was an epitome of youth symphonies. And Marv created it, and he did his dissertation on those kids. That's what his dissertation was. And so Wisconsin, in 1966, we had no youth symphony. We only had about four high schools that had orchestras. There were no orchestras. Marv, you came to Wisconsin to start the Wisconsin State Spring Development Program, but there was no spring. What were you thinking? And so Marv came in. He says, well, you know what we got to do? We have to teach the band directors how to teach strings. And everybody, we're at the table. We're going, what? There's this George Bornoff and some woman named La Carpentier, a cellist. George Bornoff there was a Bornoff system, B-O-R-N-O-F-F, system for playing violin. And so, and it was very accessible. And we started George Bornoff workshops for band directors. And Mike and I were ministering these things. We brought them in. And these band directors started playing, and the Bornoff system was so good that they could get pretty accomplished. It was just kind of a special
Now, did they come kicking and screaming because their school district told them they had to, or was this something they wanted to do?
Have you ever heard anybody say no to Marv Raidman?
No.
It started slowly, but then he says we have to have a youth symphony. And because we have to have an example, we have to get them from all over the state. And he found a few places that had orchestras, and they send their best kids. And the way I tell it is funny, because I just started in the apartment. You know, Marv just came, and so Dick says, "What are you doing Saturday?" I said, "Oh, nothing." He says, "Well, I want you to come to the music hall, because we're having the first meeting of the Youth Symphony. I need you to help me with badges and stuff."
No, wait. Is this the music department, or is it music extension?
It's music extension is running
extension.
It.
Okay.
But we're doing it in the music hall. So I went, and I'm doing name tags and everything, and Marv has the orchestra. All the kids are playing. He's just reading through music. So this is the way I tell. Marv had to go to the bathroom, so he asked me to take over the orchestra. I did, and that's how I became assistant conductor. Because I had no idea. I wasn't a string person, but I was becoming a string person because of Marv. So then he says, "You know, we got to start kids earlier. Have you ever heard of this Suzuki program?" Not so, "I don't even know what that is." He said, "Well, there's this guy, Shiniki Suzuki, has this program where kids, they start listening. The mother has to listen to music, Vivaldi music, in the third trimester. And, you know, and then the kids start playing these little instruments, the whole thing." In 1968, we brought Shiniki Suzuki and his mother. We were the first ones to have him at the University of Wisconsin in 68. Mike George and I were, I should pound on the table, I'm pounding on the mic. Mike George and I were administering that. So what's really interesting is Rhoda Rabin. So we were getting into Suzuki before he came, and Rhoda Rabin taught our daughter Betsy, who was 60. She was born in 64. So 68, she was like 4 years old. She was studying with Rhoda Rabin on the piano, Suzuki walking up and down the keyboard. She couldn't, on the floor. And she created her own piece of music. And Rhoda had her come to the Suzuki thing, because we had one session for piano teachers. Rhoda brought Betsy there, and she played. We have an autographed copy of his book, Nurturing.
Yeah, it's right up there.
Yeah, it's right up here. And she played for him, Suzuki.
Oh, what a story.
But, I mean, I'm surprised Dick hasn't said that, because when I would go around the country and mention this kind of stuff, people would be just in awe. We were at Marv was at the beginning of it. And look what he's created. 50 years of this Youth Symphony, there's orchestras all over the state, string players, everything. And when he came, there was nothing. What was he thinking? You know, he never was able to respond to me. He said, "I never thought about it. It just seemed to be the right thing to do." He wasn't negative or critical or saying he was filling a void. He just felt it was the right thing to do. So,
you know, if we could fast forward but stay with Marv for a while, I worked as Emmett's secretary in 1973, uh-huh. And Marv, and this by now there was a consolidated extension arts department.
Right.
And Marv at that time was very interested in Norwegian folk fiddling.
Right.
Do you know anything about his interest in the folk music programs?
But the only thing I'll say is that when I was involved with the Institute for Advanced Musical Studies in Switzerland, L'Institut Musical, and we were recruiting American string players, who did we call? Marv. Because Marv seemed to have a personal relationship with everybody he's ever had as a student. And he just knew where they were. And then I got Dick Wolf to come over there, but we need a viola player, call Marv. And Marv would send somebody, And you remember that, how you would do that. And then we brought him there quite a bit. I brought Emmett there, too, because, I mean, Emmett just, his approach, the other thing about Emmett, I just wanted to say that the adult education people were pretty serious, you know, research-based, you know, Kreitlow and Boyd. Bob Boyd was really tough. He was my thesis, my dissertation advisor. Emmett knew that he had to create a doctoral program that he needed to have a relationship with them, and he made it happen. And the degree that I was working on, I have an ABD, open dissertation, which is another story, was the development and administration and development of the arts. There was a degree between extension of music and adult education. But adult education at that time was, a major field, and they were very serious. And Emmett just made it happen and cloaked themselves and their credibility for the program. And they bought into it. And that was really, and once again, you know, he just had these ideas, and he just knew from an interaction political point of view how to make it happen.
So did you know when you were working on your degree, Mike Worlam also was an adult ed person, and Brett did get his PhD in arts administration from there. And that's how Mike ended up over in Ag Hall with my dad. So you didn't know him
at
the time.
But I knew Louis Sherman was part of our class, and he got his degree. He finished, and Mike George and I didn't. But the other thing I wanted to say was there, Mike George just shared this with me. We did two or three adult and continuing music education symposia. And Emmett, it was his whole idea. And I said, Emmett, well, we don't have a budget for that. How we can't pay these people or whatever. And Emmett says, well, so he got Marv to go to Boston. It was this guy, Max Kaplan. He got Max Kaplan to come to give the keynote speech. Well, if Max gets invited to give the keynote speech, Boston University pays for it. So we get Max Kaplan in there, and then Emmett starts calling all these other people, and pretty soon we have a roster of 20 people. We have all these speakers and responders and everything, and the subject is adult and continuing music education. And so by that time, Dick Gordon, who was the state music head of the music association, in the magazine, I was writing articles on adult continuing music education. And so I never worked with your dad directly. He was down the hall, was always there. But this whole thing about the Wisconsin idea and community, the first time we were there, I had a colleague from St. Norbert who was the band director in, what's near Sparta, New Lisbon. I remember renting one of those big old green station wagons, and Bill Sand and I, we drive to New Lisbon, and we created a program with him where the school facilities and the band, music, would be made available to the community at large. So there'd be adults coming in and playing, and the band room would be open in the evenings and all the stuff, and we worked on that, and I wrote an article on that for the magazine. But that was Emmett's idea. But Emmett was influenced by Bob Gard about the community, has to be in the community. So we were not allowed to stay in Madison. We would go to New Lisbon, went to Mills, what's that town? Mills.
Lake Mills?
Lake Mills. And stuff like that. And try to facilitate expanded role for music, that it's adult and continuing music education.
So what did the Wisconsin idea mean to you guys? It meant getting out of Madison?
Yes, out of Madison, into the communities, and take whatever was there and facilitate interaction between the trained professionals in the community, educators, and the community. So,
So basically, you as trained musicians,
right,
trained educators, right, would work with whoever in the community wanted to learn.
Yeah,
something.
But we didn't do the actual teaching. We facilitated. So we would work with the high school music teachers or the grade school, the actual teachers, and what we talked to the superintendent of schools to get them to allow the facilities to become more like a public library instead of being exclusive for the high school kids or the middle, junior high kids in those days. So, but these symposiums that went on, Mike George pulled out, we had complete, what do you call them, text, you know, the actual, what everybody said and everything, and brought these people together. And I remember meeting with people from the University of Illinois Extension, and everybody looked up to Wisconsin Extension music, just really the arts, because of all the arts, because of everything we did. So the whole idea about GUARD, I mean, the camp, the state is the campus, and we would just reach out and do all these things. Marv would drive all the way to Wausau to give a, you know, Bornoff workshop for teachers. And we didn't even think Marv would live to be more than 3 years older than when he started there, because he would actually mark scores while he was driving. Such a basket case in that regard. But now that I talked through with it, what an exciting time it was. And we were the envy. So, we can come back and talk more about Mar, but just so you know, what happened to me then, because of Emmett and what he did and this grant thing, MENC knew about us. They knew us intimately. They were everything. Well, go talk to the University of Wisconsin Extension people. And there was a guy who was president of the Music Educators National Conference named Wiley Housewright. And Wiley Housewright was the dean of the School of Music at Florida State University, Tallahassee. So because of Emmett and him making sure the MENC was involved in everything, I was working with the MENC, and I was, you know, a gopher, of course, but I was with Wiley Housewright. And Wiley Housewright intimately knew what Emmett Sarig was doing. Wiley Housewright wanted Florida State to have an extension arts department. And he thought the answer was to get me down there because we were working together. And when I went to Florida State in 1969, they had a division of continuing education, no extension, the division of continuing education at the School of Music. And I specifically had a position designed for me, half-time School of Music, half-time division of ed. I had an office in each place. And my job was to travel the state to find out the needs of music teachers and design programs with the resources of FSU. Okay, so anyhow, it was all because of how Emmett, you see how Emmett operated? He just made us the icon operation in the United States with his instincts. His instincts were always there.
So where was Dick Wolf during all of this time?
Well, he was the best, the biggest support system Emmett ever had.
So
but he was running the music school. Yeah, he
mm-hmm.
was running the music clinic, which was a big thing. But then he was in charge of administering Marv. I mean, Emmett had three of us working for Marv to support everything he did. So when I tell people that We did the Suzuki workshop, the Bornoff workshop, the youth music workshop, 3 adult and continuing music education symposia, all this stuff. People just couldn't believe it. And how that all dribbled away. And I looked at the interview like Dick Wolf had. It was really sad. There was so much consternation, I think, when Dick... So anyhow, eventually the story, when I get to Switzerland, we were frustrated that we didn't have an organized administrator to help pull all these 150 musicians together and schedule everything. I said, I have an idea.
I love it.
And so I got on a plane and I went to Madison
and I talked to the right people. Oh, gosh. Well, so backing up for a second, so you went from Madison to Florida State?
Yes.
And then were you on the faculty there or
yes.
were you more of a consultant?
No, faculty.
You were faculty.
And I got an appointment. Yeah.
And how long did you stay at Florida State?
Of 69. Oh.
So let's just pause for a second here. Okay, we're continuing here, and Dick is now on his way to Florida State.
It was unfortunate, you know, that people at Wisconsin Extension Arts had no idea of how the program was worshipped around the country. And the fact that Wiley Housewright really wanted me to create that kind of energy around the School of Music and Division of Continuing Education. But just to go back to how important what I learned from Emmett in terms of how to operate, when I got to Florida State, my job was to travel the state. So I would go with, I couldn't believe this, with the recruiting, they had 1,200 music majors at Florida State. So we would travel the state to recruit. But Florida is a big state. It's like 900 miles from Tallahassee to Miami. They had a Queen Air plane. So we would take off in a plane. I just thought I was dying, gone to heaven. You know, but anyhow, to connect with what Emmett did for me, Florida State was considered kind of snobbish by a lot of the people in the field. And so we had to go to Miami to recruit things, and guess who was in Miami? Howard Doolin. He was the guy that Emmett made look a hero when they came to the Youth Music Project. So now I come as an assistant professor, and the other faculty that were with me from Florida State couldn't believe how I was received by this irascible curmudgeon, Howard Doolin, who thought that his was the only program in the world and that Florida State couldn't help him. And now that I talk about it and think about it, Emmett taught me kind of a style that I adopted to make things happen. Which was a very direct, personal thing, and emphasizing networking. And it paid off. You said once before you wanted to go back and get more of Marv before we go much further. You know, Marv and I never stopped our relationship. We were working together all the time because... So the Wisconsin thing was so important to me. So I get into my job at the Division of Continuing Education, assistant professor, and I meet Bill White and Bill Robinson and Joe White, who are running the second International Horn Society. They created an organization called the International Horn Society. So now I come in and I'm in charge of managing that. I'm the Dick Wolf for that program. And they say, well, we got to get all these world great horn players. And, you know, do you ever hear this guy, John Barrows? We never could get him to respond. I went to Madison. John Barrows and I sat next to each other in the Madison Symphony for years. And, you know, John was considered the iconic horn player. And I got John Barrows to come to the International Horn Society. And because of that, 2 or 3 other major horn players came. We used to have like 12 or 13 horn players, some major symphonies around the world. Blatsky, Otto, and all this stuff came, and we had the International Horn Society. And so I was responsible for years 2, 3, and 4 in setting it up. So, so then what I learned from extension, there was a guy from the University of Kansas, Don Michelle, was on the faculty at Florida State, and he was teaching a subject called music therapy, which I never heard of. And so I was in charge of working with Don Michelle to create a music therapy national workshop. And this was in 69, 70. And I knew how to do it, you know, and I did it in continuing education. But this is why I think about my career as a Forrest Gump experience. I wasn't the music therapy guy. I didn't know. I was learning all along, but I was in charge of making that thing happen, and I met this whole field of music therapy open to me. So then Wiley Housewright sang with a Roger Wagner chorale in New York, and he was New York-focused, and I think it was Roger Wagner chorale. And then he became the dean at Florida State, and then he felt that the world revolved around New York and Boston. So a lot of the faculty, like Elena Nicolaidi, a very famous soprano, retired and was at the faculty of Florida State. So Richard Bergen, who for years was the concertmaster of the Boston Symphony, retired, and he's at Florida State. So Wiley says, go get a workshop going with Bergen. So I created this national string workshop. And I was talking to Marv all the time because Marv ran the Youth Symphony in Boston and knew these guys. And so Bergen, when Marv told Bergen that I had worked with Marv, my credibility factor just went way up. And so we created this national string symposium. And Bergen, and we had Henry Portnoy, the bass, principal bass from the Boston Symphony came, and Wiley Housewright. This is exactly what he wanted. He wanted that University of Wisconsin Extension national recognition. So we did the International Horn Society, we did the music therapy workshop, we did the National String Symposium, and that was my job. I was getting paid to do that. And it was really exciting. So, and then I'm meeting all these players from world-class musicians are all part of this, they're all connecting. So what happened is a guy named Daniel Revenaugh, R-E-V-E-N-A-U-G-H, Danielle with two L's, no E, was the conductor, artistic director of the Jacksonville Symphony. So he got me to come to Jacksonville because the Jacksonville Symphony was small. He wanted to add strings, but they didn't have any money. So he said, he and I came up with this idea that we could get student string players who were high 1,200 majors, good ones, to play in the Jacksonville Symphony for continuing education credit, which I would set up with the Division of Continuing Education. And so what happened there was that Revenaugh was a real wild character, very creative, and he was a pianist, and he studied at Florida State. And he actually was a fanatic Bizzoni. Federico Bizzoni was a famous pianist, and Revenaugh created the Bizzoni Society. But he wanted to, he and I were cooking up this idea for the Electric Symphony because symphony orchestras were losing audiences and they were confined to the concert hall. So the idea was to use technology to get the symphony to be able to play in other venues, amplification, which was a youth music project, kind of scary off-the-wall idea. And so I was working with him, and I was traveling over there as part of my job to Jacksonville, and he wanted to do his Electric Symphony project, and so I was working on it officially, and it got to be, we started getting support from California companies, and actually Florida State was getting squeamish about doing a major project like this, Electric Symphony, in California, because that's not close to Florida. And so I ended up, that was basically my, I ended up leaving Florida State because the Electric Symphony was going so fast and I was so important to raising all the money that we ended up going to Berkeley, California. So here's a Wisconsin connection. The Bozzoni Society, Danny Rivernaugh took me to Blue Mounds, Wisconsin. And there was this weird guy named Gunnar Johansson that I heard of when I was at Madison. He was a sensational pianist. And so we go to Blue Mounds, Wisconsin, and I find out that he's recording all the works of Liszt and Bach, his own recording, and he's got them all in his building. He's just making his own recording company. So we go to see him. And so Gunnar senses that I'm kind of a facilitator, so he starts pitching to Danny and me. He has this idea for creating the Leonardo Academy. And he's working with a couple colleagues I never heard of, Linus Pauling, Bill Lear, and Gunnar Johansson, who I thought was this practice room soul piano player, is an expert on supersonic transport with Bill Lear. They're talking about planes. They bought Sea Ranch, Northern California, for where the Leonardo Academy was going to be, and the first thing they built was a runway so that Lear could take everybody up there with the jet. And Linus Pauling was involved with that stuff, and I didn't meet these people, but Gunnar is talking, and he's an expert on the vitamin C and all the health stuff, and he's into the supersonic transport, which was something. This was in 70, 69, 70. So right when we went to the moon. And what happened to me is I owe this all to this Wisconsin Extension thing, which took me from the Packer Band and the high school band director, Madison East. Now I'm in all these circles. And that's why I call it a Forrest Gump experience, because we were always working there trying to put it together. So Rivernaugh was, he's very criticized and he was really very wild. But he hired the London Symphony so he could conduct the Bozzoni Piano Concerto and made a recording of it, which was acclaimed. And he paid for it all himself. I end up going to Berkeley, and we moved the whole family. I left Florida State, and we lived in Concord, and the Electric Symphony was in Berkeley. So now I'm working with the Berkeley Unified School District to get musicians to experiment with all the Electric Symphony stuff. Well, Rivernaugh, we get Don Buchla to be our engineer. Don Buchla invented the synthesizer. The first synthesizer at the Smithsonian is Don Buchla. Moog, who you think invented it, is the Henry Ford of the synthesizer. He popularized it and made it go, but Buchla invented it. So we got Don Buchla, and then we got two guys from the Grateful Dead, John Mayer and John Curl, who did the sound for the Grateful Dead. I just went to see John Mayer I'm working on this project in Manzanillo, Mexico. They want to build a performing arts center for this children's home. I went to see John Mayer and Sound. John Mayer Sound is a major acoustic company in the world. He just came from Switzerland because I got him the job when we built a recording studio in Switzerland at Friday Institute, and John did all the sound. And John was doing the Montreux Jazz Festival. I just went to see him because he has this system where they build these rooms where you have a iPad, symphony orchestra, you have perfect acoustics, lecture, perfect acoustics, chamber music, perfect acoustics. I mean, it's a John Meyer sound. And he's got an office in Berkeley. But anyhow, John Meyer was building the speakers for Electric Symphony for us with John Krill. And we did our first concert at the Electric Symphony Orchestra, debuted at Zellerbach Auditorium on the campus of Berkeley. We were working with Berkeley and the Unified School District and members of the San Francisco Symphony. So, I mean, it's kind of weird how this all went, but... So while I was at Florida State and while I was going to Jacksonville to talk to Danny Revenaugh, he said, there's this guy that I'm working with named Dmitry Markovich. And people in Russia would say it would be Markevich, but Dmitry pronounced it Markovich. His brother, Igor Markevich, was a major conductor in Russia. And Dmitry was setting up a school, a music school, the Institute for Advanced Musical Studies in Sion, Switzerland. And Danny said, so when I went to Florida State, then I had to finish my PhD. So they sent me, Florida State one summer sent me back to Madison to work with Bob Boyd, because I did my research on the music teachers, changing the attitudes for continuing education for music teachers, professional development, because that was what I was working with. So I was gathering this information. I was working on my dissertation with Bob Boyd. I went to Madison, and Revenaugh called me. He says, you got to come to Switzerland and look at this. I can't afford it. I'll send you a ticket. So I went. So there I met with Markovich and everything, and they made me the United States. I was to recruit students in the United States to go to this institute, which had not opened yet, which was being developed. And I was a professor at Florida State. So I put together a 10-member committee of deans of major music schools in the United States. Wiley Housewright is my boss. He's on the committee. I get the guy from USC, Grant Bulgarian from USC, Joe Polisi from Juilliard. I got them all on this committee because we were going to recruit the best music students to go to Switzerland when they had this idea for the institute. And this is, you're going to laugh. The students are in residence and the faculty is transient because the institute targeted the world's best musicians who never allied on a campus to have a job. They're performing. But they would come 2 weeks to Switzerland. Mario, you're a famous violinist. Would you come to Switzerland for 2 weeks to work with these kids? And we took over a hotel, and we had the hotel. So the musicians, these Zeno, Francis Scotti, and Paul Doctor, Gregor Piatigorsky, all these people we had on the faculty, and we would have meals together in Switzerland, but it'd be how I got there. So anyhow, I was recruiting students for the institute, but I was at Florida State. And I went to Electric Symphony, and we were doing that. It was kind of a project as opposed to a job. I mean, and what you need to know is that in 1971, 72, there were no direct pickups for instruments. In other words, to replace a mic, put a pickup on an instrument. There was one, Carl Countryman, played it, put a thing on a harpsichord, so the mic would pick up the harpsichord directly, direct line pickup. Well, with the Electric Symphony, we developed direct line pickups for trumpets, oboes, violins, and Don Buchla created these boxes. So one of the boxes that Buchla created was violin pickup from the bridge, would go into this box, and it would delay the attack and the decay of the note randomly, so that one violin would sound like six randomly. So the Electric Symphony, we had two first violins, two seconds, two violas, two basses, and then all the other instruments. And Buchla designed this stuff and created it. So I was working with Don Buchla. So I was the Dick Wolf and the Dick Zeller. I was raising money for the program to do that. And so Marcus Berry, which was a company in L.A., ended up having a whole product line, and we changed recording studios. All the recording studios and pit orchestras could dramatically change the makeup of their things because of the stuff we developed for the Electric Symphony. And John Meyer created the JMC speaker, which he built his company on, which is the biggest company in the world today. And when I told him, I said, I have this project in Mexico, he says, well, we have an office in Mexico City. So anyhow, that was really heady times. But it was all, and so it was all on the back of Marv Raymond and Emmett Sarek, my style and the contacts, John Barrows, and when I dropped these names, people just thought I was credible.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Did you ever come back to Wisconsin?
Yeah, I stayed in touch all the time. I brought Emmett to the Electric Symphony. I brought Emmett to the Institute. Well, so what happened is, so now I recruited a bunch of people. You know what I did? We wanted to have, I went to Green Bay and got the Green Bay band, University of Wisconsin Green Bay band. Bob Bauer was the band director. I got them to come. And Talenti, so the guy that funded the Institute, Pierre Talenti, paid for everything. So I went to Pan Am in San Francisco and chartered a plane to pick up everybody in Chicago to get them to Switzerland. And Markovich lost the buildings that he had under control in Sion, where the Institute was going to be. And I had recruited all these students. So I get a call from Pierre Talenti. You come to Rome. So I go to Rome. And it's a big passable problem. And Danny Rebinow and I put together a budget for Talenti to approve. And we went to Switzerland. And we went up to Cran Soucier, the Hotel de Lettrier, and we cut a deal for the whole hotel and set up the Institute and started it in the summer of 73.
Wow, that's incredible.
And
that's incredible.
Marv Raymond is helping me recruit students. You know who else I brought there? There are all these Swiss bands. They call them fanfas in the little towns. Guess what music they play? Sousa. Who's the number one Sousa expert at this time? Ray Dvorak.
So you brought Ray to Switzerland?
I brought Ray to Switzerland and had him lead and teach these people how to play Sousa's music, because Ray was the last librarian after Sousa band disbanded, put the library away.
That's incredible. So how long were you in Switzerland?
4 years. We had 4 years, and then after the first year... And then we had, you know, Danny Rebinow left, and I took over, but you see, it was still all Wisconsin. I mean, it was all that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I missed one story. Emmett Sarek, when we first got there, he got Marv Raven. He wanted the School of Music to hire a Gary Carr, K-A-R-R, who was a bass player who plays violin concerti on the string bass. And the School of Music didn't want to do it. So Emmett did it. He hung, and Gary Carr came to be Extension Music. You know what my first job was for Gary Carr? The International Institute of the String Bass. I have a picture of 150 bass players lined up on the edge of Lake Mendota. Gary Carr was the biggest name in string bass. And Marv moved by Gary Carr. But the credibility, just what happened in Madison. So when I tick off all these things, and once again, I don't get to talk to people because I can't say I did this, I did that. It was, that's why I really like my approach at Forrest Gump. I mean, I was just there. You know, I'm in the picture. I mean, I'm actually working, you know, what Dick Wolf told me to do. I mean, Dick Wolf was pulling the strings, but we were the ground troops, you know, Mike George, Dick Zellner, and we're running around doing this stuff for Marv. And, I mean, what a, I mean, you could see why I could never go back to Madison East.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, why do I remember that you were associated with the Union Theater? Is that true, or did I just make that up?
Only through Hare's Foot with Jim Christensen and playing on the patio with Raid of Rock with the summer band and everything. Mike George was had an extension job, but the guy Dawson... Len Dawson?
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, he was, and see, that's the other thing. You know, eventually I ended up managing the East County Performing Arts Center in San Diego and basically producing big act shows. Well, who taught me that? I was in the shadow of Len Dawson running the Wisconsin, that union program where he would bring in all these terrific internationally acclaimed performers.
So even though you weren't in Wisconsin after the late 1960s.
69, I left.
69.
66, 69 was extension of that.
Your whole career was influenced by the people, your mentors at Wisconsin, their way of doing things.
And yes, and network.
Well, one thing I've always known.
But the credibility, I mean, you don't, I mean, to go, I mean, can you imagine a guy going to Miami, one of the biggest school districts, and talking to the music supervisor, and he respects me because I was with Emmett Sarek in the youth music program in Wisconsin, and he doesn't want to talk to anybody else?
That is incredible. Well, one thing in the time that I've known you, one of the things I've always thought of you as is sort of Mr. Entrepreneurial Thinking. I don't think you've ever thought in a ordinary textbook way about anything.
And that was Sarek. That's and where the switch flipped.
I was just wondering about that. So those were the guys who just taught you to the sky's the limit in having ideas.
And Dick Wolf taught me how to put it together to make it work for Sarek. Because Sarek couldn't do it, but Dick did it. Marv was a basket case in terms of administration, but Dick Wolf just made it work beautifully.
So Rabin and Sarek were the visionaries. Wolf was the administrative genius.
And I was a flunky, you know, the ground troops.
Well, you were learning it all.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the Forrest Gump thing that I keep thinking about. Now that I talk about, I haven't talked about this like this before, how it all came together. Days. Such momentum. So, the Horn Society. So, the International Horn Society, and you know, Gunther Schuller was, and when Barrows came, Gunther Schuller came. And so they think that I'm walking on water and I'm just Forrest Gump here. So, what happened is, we did a third one. So then I go to Switzerland. And one of the groups that I bring to Switzerland is the New York Brass Quintet. I hire them. So the New York Brass Quintet comes. So who's the tuba player? Harvey Phillips. So so Harvey is one of my heroes. Just like I did a thing. We created an organization called Minds Unlimited, taking philosophically based heroes and trying to help them promote what they do because they don't promote themselves. So Harvey was teaching tuba at Juilliard, and he played in the New York Philharmonic, and he had the only tuba job in the country. There were no other symphonies that had paid a tuba. And he had 32 students. And so he could have ignored it. He could have quit. He decided to change the profession. So he founded the Tubists Union Brotherhood Association, an acronym TUBA. And he just passed away about 3 years ago. And so during the, so he created the Santa Tuba Christmases, you know, all the Santa Claus old. He started that in New York. I went to one in NBC, the Rockefeller Center, and ICE. He had all these tuba, and he's got an organization. He had over 250 composers commissioned to write music for tuba and for brass quintet. And now, every college and university that has a serious music department has a brass quintet with a tuba. A lot of symphonies have two paid tuba positions. And so that was, what were you thinking, Harvey? How did you do that? He's got the foundation. So, we meet in New York, the New York Brass Quintet comes to the Institute in Switzerland. And Harvey says, you know, we got to get together all the brass organizations in one place. So, can we stop a minute?
Sure. And we're back again. What was that you were saying about?
Well, all these different projects that I pulled off, and, you know, I'm always amazed at the respect that I receive when people understand my Wisconsin connection. And I mentioned Marv Raven and Gary Carr and Emmett Sarig, you know, Dick Wolf, all the stuff we've done and how it inspired me to get all these other things going.
That's incredible. I mean, the vision of people, the vision of this Wisconsin idea always amazes me that the arts belong in the hand of the people. The people should be making and teaching and creating their own art. There's nothing you can't do. It's incredible to me.
The one thing I think that I took away from Wisconsin is that they never felt exclusive. Everything they did, they included the best that they could get and brought them in. They never shied away from anything that would be considered competition or criticisms. They included everybody and brought them in and treated them with respect, and the synergistic effect of all that, it was always just amazing.
Well, I remember, as a parallel, people remembering the School of the Arts at Rhinelander that my dad had started.
Right.
And, you know, it was for every man, right? It was for anybody who wanted to write could come up there for a week or 2 weeks. But the artists in residence that they had there were people like Archibald MacLeish or Jesse Stewart or Studs Terkel. It was, where else could you, as an ordinary Joe, interact with Studs Terkel, have a drink on the terrace with Studs and talk about your life? And Mark Lefebvre remembers that the artists would inevitably leave saying, I'm the one that grew as a result of this. It sounds like you were just doing the exact same thing, using all your connections to bring the best people to meet the people.
Right.
Oh, man.
So you would have a half hour left or so, but let me just run a couple quick things that I think now that the thread is going in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So when we ran the Institute in Switzerland, it was privately funded for many years. And so we were raising money in America to bring to Switzerland. And after America 72 went off the gold standard with the floating currencies, it was really difficult. There was no euro in those days. So the idea was to try to move the Institute to the United States so we could sustain it, because we couldn't sustain it in Switzerland. So I got connected with USC, University of Southern California. The reason was is that Pierre Talenti, who gave the money, millions of dollars, to help us run this Institute, because it was full scholarship. We paid for travel, room, and board for the best musicians. That's why Marv didn't have any trouble getting people to come. But he, so Talenti was head of the Republican Party in Europe in these days with Nixon administration, and Herb Klein was the director of communications for Nixon. And so I remember a story one time when I was at Talenti's chalet in Switzerland, which was near the Institute. Henry Kissinger called Talenti and Klein to tell alert business people in Europe that America was going to go off the gold standard. That's another, so Forrest Gump, here's the Packer band trumpet player. So, but anyhow, Herb Klein, we set up a foundation in Washington, D.C. to get tax deduction for money for the Institute. And Herb Klein was on the board. Marv Rabin was on the board. I got Marv on the board because Marv was our recruiting students for us because of his credibility. So even, you know, into the mid-late 70s, I was still working the Wisconsin thing. It was my network, and we were making it all happen. It was called Musical Arts Development. We didn't think about the acronym MAD. But anyhow, so then we were setting up, so Herb Klein got me in touch with USC, and Grant Baglarian, the composer and stuff, was the dean at USC, and they had a campus in Idlewild. And so we moved there, and I met a guy named Richard Colburn, who has a lot of money, who just now, his estate, created the Colburn School of Music, which is right across the street from Disney Hall in L.A. So Colburn was financing the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra. And so they wanted me on the board because of my background. So I got on the board, and eventually the Institute thing wasn't going to go, and I got hooked into being a manager, executive director, development director of the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra. So this is funny. So now I've got that job. So I, a few years before that, 74, we hired Gerard Schwartz to come. He was the principal trumpet of the New York Philharmonic. And we brought him to Switzerland, and he came into the room with a handful of scores and batons. And we hired him as a trumpet player. He wanted to be a conductor. And he was going to school in the back row of the brass section at the New York Philharmonic. Leonard Bernstein's conducting. He's trying to be a conductor. So I get to the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra. They have a big problem. Neville Mariner is pissed and wants to quit immediately. And I had to, because one of the board members, the board, he wanted to program Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony. And the board said, you can't do that because that's for the Philharmonic, the Chamber Orchestra. But Neville said, well, the Chamber Orchestra, it was written for Chamber Orchestra. Anyhow, they got in a big fight, and so the bottom line was, I got to fix it. So I talked to Neville, and I said, if you don't have to talk to any board member, you only talk to me, will you stay a year while we search? Neville said, okay. I went to the board. I said, board, I'll get Neville to stay for one more season as long as you connect him through me. It worked. So now we had to do a search. And so we had Mario Bernardi from Canada, and we had Barry Tuckwell and everything. And I said, let's try Gerard Schwartz. And I brought in the executive director, Ed Birdwell. See, I did some concerts from the Institute at Carnegie Hall. Ed Birdwell was the assistant director. And so I did Gary Carr at Carnegie, representing the Institute. And I did Adrian von Woudenberg and Donzi Woodwind Quintet from Amsterdam from the Concertgebouw Orchestra. And I met Ed, and we worked together. And so I didn't want to be the executive director of the L.A. Chamber Orchestra because I was still hoping to bring the Institute to life. So I got Ed to come in. Ed was a founding member of the American Brass Quintet. And guess who the first trumpet player was? Gerard Schwartz. Ed didn't even know that Jerry wanted to be a conductor. We brought Jerry in, and he won the auditions. He won the musicians, and he took over the LA Chamber Orchestra and took them on. In 1982, we were the most recorded orchestra in the country because Jerry, we were recording. We did Vivaldi, The Seasons, and all this recording stuff was really fun. But anyhow, that's how that string went.
And so yeah.
Now the Colorado connection. So the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, we were involved with the Pasadena Ambassador Auditorium, and then I ended up leaving, and it was so frustrating working with unions and stuff in L.A. and everything. And I was still had this Wisconsin, this Marv Rabin and the kids and all this stuff. So this orchestra in Colorado, the Colorado Philharmonic, was looking for an executive director. And I really liked the idea that they would audition all these kids and bring them here for a repertory experience, and then they would go on to symphonies. I felt that would be the environment I wanted to be in. In 1973, when I was recruiting for the Institute, I flew to Evergreen, and I flew to Denver, drove to Evergreen, and met Walter Charles and his wife, Virginia, that founded Colorado Philharmonic. And I got them to allow me to speak to the orchestra to get these kids to come. So I knew about Colorado and the Philharmonic. So when the job came open, I thought, that's what I want to do. So nobody would talk to me. They thought I was overqualified. And so Arnie Langberg, I was on the board, and he says, well, let's bring this guy out and see what he's like. And they flew me out, and I stayed at Arnie Langberg's house, and I got interviewed. And so what happened is they would offer me the job, but they couldn't pay me as much as I needed. They couldn't match my salary. So I said, I'll take your salary on the condition that I can have a certain amount of days to consult. So Ed Birdwell, in the summertime, worked for Gordon Hardy at Juilliard and managed, he was the Dick Wolf of the Aspen Music Institute. And he got me a consulting job to set up the development department for Aspen Music Festival. And so I came here to work for the Colorado Philharmonic, and then I had, in those days, they used to send me a book of tickets. I would just go get on the plane and fly to Aspen in those Convair 580s. Boom, boom, boom. But it was just the network that did it. And then finally, the Colorado Philharmonic got to the point where we could do things, and we changed the name to the National Repertory Orchestra because we got invited to play at the Kennedy Center for the 20th anniversary. You know how I got that? Ed Birdwell became head of the music program for the National Endowment for the Arts. And I went to his apartment in New York, and he said, I got this 20th anniversary coming up. We're going to do a concert. I don't know which orchestra to bring, because if I invite an orchestra, all the others are going to be mad. I said, I got the perfect orchestra. I got this Colorado Philharmonic, all these kids. And so Ed set it up, and we got the orchestra there.
And then you were the national repertory.
Yeah, and Charlton Heston was the head of the campaign, and he did Lincoln Portrait and did stuff. And we had the Billy Taylor Trio. We did a concerto for the jazz trio, Billy Taylor. But can you see that this is how Sarig would have done it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because it's got nothing to do with the mainstream.
So
now that I look back at
you
it.
You stayed in touch with Sarig and Rabin.
I used to go visit him.
Probably.
I went to visit him in Arizona. Because when he went there, he was heading up that, what's that big elk facility, that big amphitheater? He was doing the programming. He was on that committee
when
he was retired. I remember his wife had a stroke, which kind of made it difficult for them, but she was doing pretty good.
That's incredible. So it's not only the people, but their inspiration, the way they taught you to think,
yep.
the connections they gave you, the attitudes they gave you.
Right. It cloaked me in that reputation.
You know, I keep coming
but
back.
It's only Forrest Gump.
Exactly. Well, except Forrest Gump was in the right, not only was he in the right place at the right time, but he recognized it. He knew how to take advantage of it. And that's something that Emmett and Dick used to do.
Right. But, and nothing is impossible in their minds. I mean, so you can see why I was thinking, like I was going back over Marv's career, what were you thinking? There was nothing there.
So if there is, so what, if somebody said to you, what were you thinking? How would you answer that?
I was just teaming up with people. I mean, helping facilitate ideas that we generated. I think that's the best way. I mean, I just, we would do anything for Marv or Emmett or Dick Wolf. I mean, look at the, I mean, you know, Dick Wolf, the whole music clinic thing. I mean, there were periods in the last 20 years where almost every musician in the country had a connection to the Wisconsin Music Clinic.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, even after I left Madison when I graduated from high school, if I was talking to a music educator, they would ask me if I knew about the music clinics and and the Camp Randall experiences for kids.
Yeah.
Huh. So how would you like to be remembered, Dick? If I was one of your... There are surely a lot of people out there who are to you as you've been to Dick and Marv, just sort of a carrier of their torch. Yeah. What would you want them to say about you?
I don't know. There's one guy, Ed Estrada, who was my production manager at East County Performing Arts Center, San Diego. He was so good. He ran the backstage, was so professional. And just to give you, so I recommended him to Gene Brody's program at
Temple?
No. The other one.
Goucher?
No, she was in Philadelphia. Come on. Drexel.
Drexel, that's right.
And when I wrote in the recommendation, you know, we had Tommy Toon and the Rhythm Kings we were presenting. Tommy Toon came up to me and he said, Dick, you know, I really, you have a terrific staff. This is great. What you guys do backstage. He said, I'd like to do some off-Broadway here. I said, we can't do off-Broadway. We don't have all the... Oh, he says, we don't want that. We want it scaled. I want to work with your staff. Then we brought in Diavolo, the dance company, which Jacques Haim founded. Jacques Haim was one of the co-founders of Cirque du Soleil, but they split early on. And Jacques founded Diavolo because he... didn't want to go so far in the show business, aerobatic stuff. He wanted, but he does dances on contraptions. Well, we brought the Avalo Dance Company in residence for 2 weeks, two different years. They're so impressed with what Ed did that when they go to Korea or South America, they hire Ed to interface with the performing arts centers in those places. That's the kind of guy he is. Ed went to Gene's program and got his master's degree in arts administration, straight A's. It was just terrific. And he didn't think he could do it, but that's when, you know, I was really proud that I got him in that thing.
Are you doing any consulting now?
Yeah, I'm working with the Children's Foundation in Loveland, which operates abandoned children's home in Manzanillo, Mexico.
And they're
trying to build a small performing arts center because they use the arts to help the kids achieve self-esteem and self-confidence, all the kids. And they have this folkloric and dance company that I would hire them on my season if I was running a performing arts center.
I feel Marv Rabin up there smiling at you.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
But that's all. I'm not doing too much anymore consulting. So, but I was, you know, you kind of inspired me to kind of revisit this whole thing.
Well, this is an amazing story. And I hope in February when you and Dick and Mike George are all in Madison together, we can talk more just about Emmett and more just about Marv.
Right.
And we haven't talked about Ed Hugdahl at all, but just remembering him too, because he did some interesting
programs. The church, the organ stuff, and the church things.
Music for the small church.
But he was so independent and so efficient.
Yeah.
I mean, I worked with him for him, actually, with that Wisconsin band program at the state fair.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, he was always there, and he was always fun, he thought we were off the wall with the Youth Music Project, but he, you know, supported us. And
what a wonderful story. Well, I think I'm going to wind up this tape, but hopefully to be continued in February when you all are there, and we can have a conversation with maybe Harv and me, sort of kind of asking the questions or facilitating or just sitting at your feet as the next generation. Thank you so much, Dick. This has been
welcome.
A pleasure.
That's
and
fun.
I'm sure there'll 20 more questions
lots
will occur to me afterwards. And
lots
I'll
of
ask
memories.
You later, I'm sure.